Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guest is Lisa C. She is the New York Times bestselling author of Lady Tan's Circle of Women, The Island of Sea Women, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Peony in Love, Shanghai Girls, China Doll, and Dreams of Joy, which debuted at number one. She is also the author of On Gold Mountain, which tells the story of her Chinese-American family's settlement in Los Angeles. She was the recipient of the Golden Spike Award from the Chinese Historical Association of Southern California and the History Makers Award from the Chinese-American Museum. She was also named National Woman of the Year by the Organization of Chinese-American Women. And today we are going to talk about her journey with AS. Lisa, welcome to SpondyCast.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are glad you're here, and we're going to talk about your journey or your story. So you received a delayed diagnosis when it was kind of considered a man's disease. What was that like for you, especially as a young woman?
So I started having back problems when I was 13. And, my mom, well, I say a lot of things about my mom. My mom was a bit of a magical thinker. And so, first of all, any kind of physical ailment, she saw that as some other kind of message. You know, like if you had a sore throat, that's because you were swallowing words that you didn't want to say, or, you know, you have a sore shoulder, that's because you feel like you're carrying the burdens of the world. So for me to say I was in pain, you know, there was always some other reason, like you don't want to take out the trash.
Right.
Which may have actually been true. So, the other thing is, you know, I'm pretty old now, and we lived in Topanga Canyon, and my mom did take me, and my parents were divorced, but my mom took me to all of these different kinds of healers of one variety or another, my dad as well, and, you know, separately. And, you know, I do remember, I think it was when I was 13, the first regular doctor I went to, he said to my mom, you know, your daughter has the back of a 70-year-old man.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, they didn't have like, why, you know, an answer to that. So anyway, things went along that way all the way until I was 40. And I finally saw someone who, you know, before that, they didn't have they didn't know about the x-ray that you could do on your hips.
Right.
And so I had that x-ray, and it was like, well, this is what you've got. And I think a lot of, you know, the reason why I wasn't diagnosed for so long was just because they didn't really know how to diagnose it.
Right. And it's been, do you mind sharing how long?
I'm going to be 70 in February.
Okay. And you were diagnosed at 40?
40.
Yeah. And I was 37, I think, was my diagnosis. So I'm with you. And
I mean, I think there's also something there with, you know, it was seen as a male disease primarily. But I also think that there's a fair amount of skepticism when women go in with certain types of ailments, you know, headache, aches and pains, tired. I mean, I did have a doctor tell me once, well, when my kids were very little, he was like, well, of course you're tired. You're a young mother. And then it turned out, you know, my thyroid was on the blitz, you know? So,
right.
You know, but it was the automatic assumption was, well, you're a young mother. And so I think, you know, certainly when I was a lot younger, before I had kids, there was that kind of dismissiveness of, of my back problems. But then after I had kids, it was like, well, you're carrying your kids. Well, you're carrying groceries. Well, you know, you can just have to expect that kind of thing. You're a woman.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of women out there who hear those things. Mm-hmm. I like to be hopeful that since we're moving toward women being more of the diagnosis, that's going away, but I still suspect there's millions and millions out there that are hearing maybe your back hurts because you need to get over your anxiety. I heard that. Yeah. For you though, was the, so you said 13 was when you started?
Right.
Okay. Do you remember the earliest symptoms you had?
Not being able to sleep through the night, waking up in the morning and being just unbelievably stiff, feeling better as the day went on. But then, it was that sleeplessness and the just, and waking up in the middle of the night in with my back in spasm, in spasms. And that just, lasted for a long time, really a long time. And then I didn't have my first real true flare up until I was 19. And when I was 19, there was a morning where I walked out of my room and fainted from the pain. And I really, the doctor, because what doctors knew then and how they treated illness just generally was go to bed. And so they sent me to bed. I got weaker and weaker. I could barely walk. I really could barely walk. And then I don't know if you want how or if you want to get into this part, but I went to see an acupuncturist.
Yeah.
This was before, I'm in California. This was before acupuncture was legal here. And it was 1978, I think. And I have to do the math on my age, but somewhere in there, in the 70s. And actually earlier, I guess. Anyway, it was early 70s. And my mom was out to dinner, and she heard someone at the next table talking about, their loved one and how this person had been in so much pain and they'd gone to see this acupuncturist. But you couldn't see one here. It was against the law. They really didn't have any, but this guy had been brought over to UCLA Medical School from China. So it was after China had opened, right? So right in there, sort of 76, 77, somewhere in there.
Was it just not, you couldn't have acupuncture in the US in the 70s because I guess I never thought of that.
Yeah.
There are some states where there's still like.
Right. Yeah. So, you couldn't have it. And UCLA Medical School had brought this guy over to teach. And sort of introduce the practice to the medical school. But he couldn't practice, it was just a sort of, it was like a cultural exchange in a way.
Right.
And so my mom's listening to this table and she told him about me and they said, well, if you want to see this guy, you have to follow this whole protocol. You call, you let the phone ring three times and you hang up. Then you wait 3 minutes, then you call, you let the phone ring twice, then you hang up, then you wait 10 minutes. I mean, it was a whole thing. Wow. Finally, my mother did it and she took me to see him. And I mean, I'm serious. I could barely walk. And I had been told I might not walk again. I'd been told if I did walk again, I would never be able to bear children. I mean, but they never talked, never said like what I had, just like, this is your future. You're going to end up in a wheelchair. I mean, it was very dire. And I had my first treatment and I walked out of there without a limp. And I, you know,
too, you wouldn't have children.
Oh, but one of the many doctors, you know, like just a regular medical doctor.
That's said egregious.
I would not be able to bear children. And
okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted. So you walked out with some.
Able to walk out. I walked out without a limp. And, you know, it did come back. And I ended up going to this guy for, you know, months. But that was the first big flare up. But we, you know, we didn't know what it was. And everything that I did at that was told to do at that time is exactly what you wouldn't say to someone now.
Right. That's incredible. And I mean, I'm a firm believer in a lot of alternatives or complementary therapies or holistic, as we, I don't know how we call them these days. But that's amazing. So it was kind of like black market style.
It was
great. Well, I shouldn't be saying that. I shouldn't endorse that, but at all, I'm not endorsing it. Call your medical.
I think the thing is, and you know, I hope for the people who are listening, I am a firm believer that you do need to try everything.
Yes.
And you don't know what's going to work for you. For some people, you know, yoga helps, right? For some people, it's like, I'm never going to do that. You know, I mean, there are those kinds of things. I did speak to a ankylosing spondylitis chapter. And we did a Zoom call together, and I was saying some of the things that I had done. And, you know, it was really interesting, people saying, I would never do that. Or I tried it and it didn't work for me. Or I tried it and it didn't work for me. That everybody's body is a little bit different.
Yes.
There's certainly different practitioners of medicine and, you know, whether it's or exercise, you know, everybody's a little different. And so that way. And so you have to just try. I mean, I think sometimes we do what the doctors tell us, but they have a pretty narrow, well, some have a pretty yeah. narrow view of what you should do and shouldn't do.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, and if you've listened to any of our episodes, I've pretty much will try anything once or twice, really.
Yeah.
But it all started for me. I was not get when they finally diagnosed me, I had probably 2 years of biologics. Nothing was working. Methotrexate. I was miserable. And my doctor just walked in one day and she said, we're going to try something. It may sound a little woo woo to you, but let's go do it. And she's like, it's not going to hurt you. And I started doing Ayurvedic, like eating and that. I credit that decision and the work. There is work behind it, right? There's not a magic pill with a lot of complementary or holistic, but the work of like changing my diet and change, like I credit it saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are so many things, or I actually was hopefully the person who I was supposed to be at a conference last week in San Francisco. And I've been going hard and I was like, I'm going to go to a yoga farm for a week and just do yoga 8 hours a day. And it is, but everybody is different. And I know that everybody has sort of a different limit, like a limit to what maybe they can or can't do. Have you, this actually rolls into like the invisibility piece to me. In many ways, you've written a little bit about this, and I want to get into your writing too, but you've written a little bit about like it being an invisible disease. How's that been for you? And I'm sure as a youth, right? Like dealing with it, that may have carried forward a bit.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, most diseases are invisible. We don't, you know, unless it's like leprosy, right?
Right.
We don't know from looking at somebody, you know, what they're experiencing, you know, whether it's like high blood pressure, low blood pressure, cancer. I mean, we don't always see that by looking at someone. Right. And so in that regard, I'd say, you know, almost all diseases, there's an invisible quality to it. And to me, then the real question is, how much do you share that, what you're going through, or what you're feeling? Some people feel very private about their medical, whatever their medical condition is. You know, they don't want people to know, oh, they've got a, you know, bad heart, or they don't want people to know that they're going through cancer treatments. They don't want people to know that there's some frailty in their bodies.
Yeah.
I don't talk about this all the time. I mean, it's funny. You mentioned that I had written about it a little bit. It's only because my rheumatologist had been asked to put together an issue of, you know, like the Journal of Rheumatology, to put together an issue and select all the topics. And he asked me to write a piece about from a patient's perspective. I didn't know so many people were going to read it, actually. I'm glad they did. And and I ended up finally putting it on my website so people could look for it. And there are people who do come to my website because they're looking up, you know, they've just been diagnosed and then they find this. And I think it's helpful. But, you know, so just going back to your question about being invisible, is how much do we share of ourselves, but also, like, you know, what's the value of the secret and what's the toll of the secret? And do we actually you know, yes, there are some things where I think people look at you differently, you know, but sure. On the other hand, that hopefully means that they can have some understanding of like, you know, I get tired. You know, I think I get more tired than the average person. And so the people who know me or the people I tell this about, like when I go out on book tour, I say, you know, I have to have a little time in the day so I can have some rest or some real rest. Because yeah. I'm traveling to a city a day and I'm doing events every day. But one of my sons, you know, we've just had the election, and during one of my sons said to me, you know, when you're out on book tour, you're like a politician. You're yes. going to a city a day. You're performing 1, 2, 3 times a day to a group, and it takes a lot out of you. So, you know, that's one thing I've told the publishers. I just need to have a little time. It doesn't have to be a long, you know, it doesn't have to be hours, but I have to have some time when I'm on tour and doing that kind, putting out that kind of energy where I can really truly just like lie down and rest for an hour.
Yeah, I'm with you. I travel quite a bit, and it's that whole like spoon. Have you seen the spoon theory? Right. You start to deplete or I call it like you're depleting like your backup battery and your backup and your triple backup and your generator. Eventually it's really hard to come back from. Yeah. And do you feel like, so if you do book tour and then you're home, like how do you manage the, and I know the question is a little bit about being isolated, but it seems like you seem to manage it pretty well, but you've got, the routine isn't a traditional 9 to 5.
Right. Well, I don't know. I don't know about isolation. I mean, I that hasn't been my experience where I have felt like this is an isolating disease. It's not contagious, right? It doesn't really, I don't feel like it stops me from doing the things that I love. I mean, there are a few things when I was young, I did love horseback riding, but I haven't been on a horse in forever because that kind of,
right.
You know, bouncing up and down in the saddle is just really bad. on my back. So, or jogging, that's another thing, you know, not that I was ever a big jogger, but that my body doesn't handle that well. But I don't see that as particularly isolating. I see that more as like choices that I'm making of what I can and can't do. Not that, oh, I'm isolated because I have this.
Yeah, I would agree with you that I would agree with you in my own experience. There was a period where I was, when you were talking about being young and having no energy and just kind of being in bed and getting sicker, I feel like that was more isolating. Once I got to a point where I could manage it, then it becomes less, I thought it was less isolating. And do you think like over the last couple decades, the treatments have helped you have a better quality of life?
For sure. I take a biologic. I really resisted it. I really resisted it. And finally, you know, the rheumatologist was like, you're going to try this and you might not notice a difference for 3 months. I mean, that first week, like you said, for you, you know, when something had, the Ayurvedic stuff had transformed your life, saved your life, I felt like that transformed my life.
Yeah.
Literally overnight.
Yeah. Well, and I know recently we had, right, with the two hurricanes on the East Coast, one of the plants that makes the IV bags for infusion was knocked out. And there were, I don't know the whole story exactly what happened, but it was for some of us, it was like over 3 weeks late where we were getting meds. I was in bad shape.
Yeah.
And you forget how awful you feel and what it takes to come back from that. It was a lot, but, so how do you, so you've got book tours, you're writing a lot. I don't like to type. I don't anymore. My fingers hurt. So I don't know how you do it. I dictate and let somebody else type it. But how do you overall, you just manage you flexibility? Is that kind of your approach to as things change?
So you mean like in the course of a day?
Yeah. I mean, do you have to have a balance somewhere throughout the day, even when you're home, as opposed to like, I know when you're on the road, it can be difficult, but I know sometimes it's hard to just kind of like move through the changes of the routine. And you seem to have a lot of that going on.
So as a writer, I sit in this chair hours and hours every day. I think for any person, there's probably nothing worse that we can be doing than sitting in front of a chair, in front of a computer for hours and hours every day. I mean, just for our posture, for our shoulders, the way we hunch over, the immobility, the way our backs are. I mean, I do have a pillow. I have a little thing that my feet sit on. Everything here, if you could see it, I am so totally aligned so that I look straight into the computer. My armrests are exactly where my arm, I mean, I'm like ergonomically as perfect as I can get because I'm here every day. But I get up every hour to 90 minutes. I walk around the house, I get tea, I go out and get the mail, but I get up and move around. I want to just preface this by saying that I always hated exercise, just absolutely hated it. But I think that's been one of the main things that has helped me. And so I do yoga twice a week, Pilates twice a week, and I play tennis 3 times a week.
Amazing.
I did Pilates for a long time. I mean, I've done it for a very, very long time, off and on. And then I had a Pilates instructor who decided, you know, had me as a project. And so at that time, I could just barely cut my fingers over my knees. That's how stiff I was.
Oh, wow.
That was as far, you know, as far as like touching my toes, that was as far as I could go. It was just to cup my knees. And he decided he was going to work with me until I could put my hands on the floor, or, you know, my fingers to the floor. And it took 2 years, but I did it. And now, you know, I'm going to maintain that. I don't know what it's going to take, but I'm going to maintain that, I hope, till I die. And, you know, all this stuff takes time every single day. You know, we're talking, so I get up every hour to 90 minutes, but I also do at least 1 hour of exercise a day. And, you know, yoga, really good for the flexibility. Yeah. And oiling the joints. I mean, I actually really, when I'm doing it, I feel like, oh, I'm actually, it's like the Tin Man. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually putting oil in there and moving them around. I still have a lot of, and maybe now that I'm older, you know, I'm having more sort of peripheral things. It's not just in my spine. So, you know, all that other connective tissue all around just wants to tighten, you know, calcify. So, the Pilates is the same kind of thing. It's strength, but it's also all that stretching.
Yes.
And then tennis, you know, this should be something I shouldn't be able to do. But I have so much fun doing it. And the one thing it's just very tough on my neck is serving. There are times when I'm going through a phase where, you know, my back is really bothering me and my body doesn't want it, you know, just really, that's like too active, but I still do it because I know if I don't, I know what the consequences are.
Right. Yes, I'm with you. This is,
and it's a very different way to exercise. It's not like I'm doing this because I want to be fit, or I'm doing this because I want to lose weight, or I'm doing this because, oh, it's just my passion. I know if I don't do it, it's going to result in pain. It's going to result in stiffness. It's going to result in not being able to sleep at night. I mean, it's all of, you know, the consequences of not doing it are way outweigh the fact that I don't necessarily enjoy doing some of it.
Yeah, that's kind of why I ran away from home last week. I'm with you. I often say I want to feel this good when I'm 80. And there's a lot of work that goes into, but I got to a point where I was like, I don't even feel good. I don't even feel decent or order. It was, and it does. And what I have also experienced, and maybe you have, if you slack off just a bit, then you're in a valley and you have got to climb out and
back up. Yeah.
It is difficult. But good for you, an hour a day.
And I give myself one day off. Good. Although usually, you know, I'll still go for a hike or a walk or something, but yeah. I don't have one of those planned, timed.
Right. That's remarkable though. Can I ask you a question about writing?
Mm-hmm.
So do you ever feel like you've brought your AS into your characters?
Never.
No, it doesn't impact your writing at all. That's so interesting.
No, I mean, I've written about, you know, I've written a lot about foot binding. But I don't, cause I was thinking about this, since that question had been sent to me earlier. And I just, I don't know if I just really, I really don't think that when I'm writing a character who's in pain, that I'm thinking of it through the, through my own experience of ankylosing spondylitis. I just don't. I don't.
It's great compartmentalization. And it's probably why you can sit in that chair all day. That's impressive. So in your, do you still get flares?
I had a pretty bad one. I got out on book tour, and I don't know. I mean, I know which book it was. It was for Dreams of Joy. I'd have to look to see how long ago that was, but it was very, it was a very hard tour. Really grinding, you know, getting up at 4 a.m, getting on the 6 o'clock plane, flying to the next city, and, you know, doing these events and then doing the same thing the next day. And it was just really tough. And I got sick, just, you know, some virus.
Right.
But that ended, and I kept going. I mean, everybody's, you know, was relying on me. So I kept going. And that did trigger eventually. I mean, it did trigger a flare up that was actually so bad and lasted so long that they thought I was developing either rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or both.
Oh, no.
I mean, rupus.
Yeah.
So that took, to actually come back from that took about 2 years.
Wow. That's a long time. And you have,
but it start, you know, it started because I was tired. Then I got a cold. Then it developed into a chest thing. Then I kept going. Then my whole immune system just totally fell apart.
Ugh.
And with lupus, it can take up to 5 years for it to fully come out. So, you know, that was 5 years, and it was like about two or three before, you know, that then everybody was like, yeah, you're not going to develop that. But it really looked like, you know, these other things were emerging.
Right.
And it was all because, you know, you were sort of talking about like going off, you know, going down, but it was like I'd gone off the cliff. And it was very hard to come back from that. And it also, you know, brought back a much higher level of just inflammation in my body.
Yeah.
Right. So I was in a lot of pain during that whole time period.
Oh, that's horrible.
And, you know, the thing is, there are painkillers out there, right? But I don't want to take the strong stuff because that has all kinds of issues attached to it, you know, issues. Yeah. And then there's only so many NSAIDs. So, you know, that stuff is not, I mean, I was taking those back then, but, and a very strong one, but it, you know, they take a toll too, and they're risky. And so when we talk about not wanting to get to that bad place, it's not just we don't want the pain. I don't want the other stuff that comes with it.
The pill bottles and the,
yeah,
as I call it, then you get into that, you can end up treating the treatment, right? Where you're like taking the NSAIDs and then you're taking something for your gut,
stomach, and yeah, all that.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah. And I remember seeing a meme or something on Facebook where somebody like opened up their cupboard in the morning and there were like 50 pill bottles and they were like, yes, I am someone with a chronic autoimmune disease. But it is, it complicates life and you're not feeling good. No, I'm with you. And you seem to have a really supportive family too, for kind of the peaks and valleys, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you know, I still wasn't diagnosed when my husband married me. And after I was diagnosed and after I, you know, started taking the anti-inflammatory, and it really was a big improvement. I still hadn't gotten the idea of exercise. That took like another 10 years before I could bring myself to do that. But I do remember this one time, you know, feeling really pretty sorry for myself. And I'll just say, and maybe you had this experience too, nobody wants to hear you have a disease.
Right.
And this isn't life threatening, you know, I mean, but you don't like to hear it. And I do remember in those early months, maybe even years, of when I would feel it in my body, when I would feel pain, when I would feel stiffness, I was like, that's the disease.
Yeah.
And it was that I really struggled with that. Just that word. And so anyway, there was one point still pretty early on, but I'd been diagnosed. So we'd already been married for like 15 years. And I was like, I'm really sorry you're married to someone with a disease, you know, and whatever. I was kind of moping around. And he said, you know, don't worry about it. When I married you, I had, my only expectation was that we should always have a house that's one story, because I knew you'd be in a wheelchair.
Oh.
So that made me love him all the more, you know.
I do.
But so yes, I think he was always very supportive. But he did it in a way, I think, that I wasn't even fully aware of, if that makes sense.
It does. That's beautiful. You're a lucky girl. So did I read somewhere, not to change topics, because I'm like getting a little verklempt, like a little love story there. But did I read somewhere that you've participated in some research studies?
I have, yeah. So that same rheumatologist, you know, it took me forever to find, first to get diagnosed, then to find a rheumatologist. You know, I had one rheumatologist fire me as a patient because he stopped treating people with ankylosing spondylitis. That was a big blow.
What?
He just was like, I'm not going to have that in my practice anymore. And it was just like, so I wasn't the only one fired as a patient, but it was a blow. Then the next one I went to, I was, like I said, I was taking a very strong anti-inflammatory. And I already been on it for something like 30 years, you know. Yeah. And he said to me, 20 years. And he said, if you keep taking this, one day you're going to throw up and you're actually hemorrhaging and you won't even make it to the hospital in time. I never went back to him. Oh. Then I saw the next one. She always was so mean to her office staff that I couldn't bear being there. She was so mean. But then she's the one who, and this was when I was in that really bad way where, you know, I'd gotten so sick and this sort of ongoing flare up, and then, you know, was it going to be rheumatoid arthritis and lupus or both? And so she wanted me to see this other rheumatologist. And she said, but you'll never get in to see him. The only way you'll ever see him is if you join his study, the study he's conducting. And so I joined that study and chatted him up a lot, you know, over many months. And then finally one day I said, will you look at my file? And, you know, and I brought it to him, and then I asked, you know, would you take me as a patient? And he said, yes. And he was great. I mean, he was really, you know, and I guess maybe that's another lesson here. It's, you know, it's not just finding what works for you in terms of exercise or what kinds of treatments you seek, but finding the right doctor is so important. And anyway, how did I get on? Well, you'd ask me a question, which I've already forgotten. Oh, the research. So yeah, so I was in that first study that went for 5 years. And then somewhere in there, they were doing other smaller studies where sometimes it was just a single blood draw or they were doing x-rays. But I felt during, you know, first of all, there was one where they had my parents and my sons and my sisters fill out questionnaires give blood for testing because they were, you know, so different, you know, yes. That was obviously a genetic testing kind of thing. And everybody said yes, because, well, everybody said yes because I asked them to, right?
Yeah.
But the idea that they could help other people, yeah. having lived, you know, known me forever, I think everybody wanted to participate and help. So my feeling, and you know where this is, and I'm in Los Angeles, it's a good hour's drive one way. So I was making a pretty big commitment, but I think because of some of my own experiences, especially when I was young, I just really felt whatever I can do in my tiny way to yeah. help participate in why do people get this? How can we treat it? What works for people? You know, they were doing these measurements with, you know, like breathing.
Yeah.
You know, okay. And how much air could I get in? And what was this tightening up? How can we help with that? I mean, all of those different kinds of things, you know, eye exams, looking at my heart, you know, looking at the heart, all the places in your body where you can be affected that aren't just your back. Right.
Right.
So I just felt like this is a small thing I can do that may or may not help me, although actually I, you know, got free x-rays and free blood tests and stuff like that. But it also was so other people wouldn't go through what I'd gone through to get diagnosed.
I'm with you. It's,
I mean, my, I guess she'd be my great aunt. She was my father's cousin. She wasn't diagnosed until she was 85.
Wow. It's a long time.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked to even a group of us that there is a tragedy in the shattered dreams when you've been living with this and not getting a diagnosis, which is really, and I think of it like when you multiply it by a couple million people.
Yeah.
And the years that go by, yeah. I don't think I actually bloomed in life until I was diagnosed at 37. And that was not that long ago, right?
And it's the wasted days. It's the hours of pain. It's the times you couldn't do something that you wanted to do something, but you felt so miserable you couldn't. Yeah. I mean, it all that adds up in a person's life. And like you said, you multiply that out across the country and around the world. It's really tremendous.
Yeah, it is. So on that note, let me ask you this, because we should wrap up our time here, though I could stay on for hours. And I might be going to order a couple books after this. As someone is newly diagnosed or like facing the diagnosis, do you have any advice for how to handle it? And particularly, I think in the context of someone who has a wonderful career and how to handle things once the diagnosis hits?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, you heard how I felt about just hearing the word disease.
Yeah.
That you are going to grieve, and it is a shock to your system. But it's also a blessing, because now you can do something. There's very little that you can do when you don't know what you're dealing with.
Right.
And there's so, you know, there are the biologics, there are the anti-inflammatories, there's exercise, there are other types of treatments you can try that are going to help you. But you have to kind of be open, you know, you've got to be open to it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really key thing, is to try to be open in a way maybe you haven't been before. You know, one of the things for me was I'm going to have to give myself a shot. No way. You know, and my husband did it for like the first 6 months. And I, you know, it was like a whole, you know, preparing thing. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I'm ready. And actually, then I went on book tour and I had to do it myself. And then I was like, well, this was not a big thing. It was just in my, you know, it was actually easier to do it myself. Better to do it myself. But I, so what I'm saying is to try to first allow yourself the space to grieve and feel terrible and feel bad and all of that, but also really to look at it as now you know what you have and you can do things that are going to make you feel better.
Yeah. Take control.
You can take, you'll have some control over your destiny instead of this nameless thing having a fair amount of control over you.
I think on that note, we should, that was a wonderful way to land.
Wonderful.
Lisa C, thank you so much. And is it lisac.com?
Uh-huh.
Amazing. If anyone wants to check out her books and
or even read that article.
That I mentioned. And read that article. Yes, we can put a link in the
There's some funny things in that, which we didn't
talk Perfect. About. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this very difficult day in the world. But let's, thank you.
Thank you so much.
SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.